I next met with Dr. Tanyos Bakai Saab, and to begin, he commented on the other landmark presentation at this year's GI Cancer Symposium, a phase 3 trial in advanced pancreatic cancer.
I think the most anticipated study is really the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel study in pancreas cancer, which, you know, for the longest time we've had all these gem plus X, gem plus Y, gem plus Z, all negative compared to gem. And this is the first proof of principle that you can actually improve activity of gemcitabine by adding an additional agent, in this situation, nab-paclitaxel.
What do we know about taxanes and pancreatic cancer in general?
You know, it's interesting. So taxanes overall have activity in pancreas cancer. They have been untapped. We knew that docetaxel added to gemcitabine and paclitaxel added to gemcitabine or paclitaxel added to 5-FU have actually had interesting activity in pancreas cancer in phase 2 studies. Never really translated into phase 3s. We've seen these signals all along. So I think taxanes overall have activity in pancreas cancer. And this study, the gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, confirms this added activity.
So this study had more than 800 patients in it and demonstrated that weekly NAB at 125 milligrams per meter squared plus GEM showed a survival advantage of 8.5 versus 6.7 months with a 0.72 hazard ratio and a similar PFS advantage.
There's a survival benefit, a progression-free survival benefit. And what I was looking at actually was the response rate, because in pancreas cancer, response rate is stubborn. In this particular study, response rate seems to be at least three times, so three-folds higher, with the addition of nab-paclitaxel. And that's very intriguing.
And as you might expect, NAB didn't add much to toxicity.
Gemcitabine, of course, its toxicity is not worsened by nab-paclitaxel, except perhaps for some of the hematologic toxicities. There will be additional neurotoxicity, but I think it would be fairly manageable, understanding, you know, the toxicity of nab-paclitaxel across other malignancies.
Sort of looking forward, and actually I want to ask you about this in terms of your own practice, how have you been approaching first-line therapy and second-line therapy, and do you think this might change?
I think this will change it dramatically. So let's think about where we were at about a year ago, a year and a half ago, all the excitement about FOLFIRINOX, a triple regimen that I call a triple threat. It was good because it induced responses. It also induced a survival benefit, but it was difficult to use in a community setting or academic setting, frankly, because of the toxicities. And although it was a welcome addition and a proof of principle that we can make a difference in this disease, it unfortunately ended up being one of the most toxic regimens we could use. Now, in my own practice, I have not adopted FOLFIRINOX except where I would use it for a limited amount of time, meaning those that I would call borderline resectable or resectable, and in some locally advanced, where you really are looking to induce a response in 3 to 4 months, and that also would limit the toxicities.
What do you see as the interesting questions that might come out of this report? And one kind of obvious question would be about adjuvant treatment.
Absolutely. So FOLFIRINOX is being looked at in adjuvant treatment. But again, I would anticipate this to be an incredibly difficult regimen to give in the adjuvant treatment. So this is where gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel gets the upper arm because it's relatively tolerable compared to the triplet regimen. It's also a very feasible regimen for patients. Frankly, think about the age limit that was set for FOLFIRINOX at 76, and a number of patients are actually older than 75 with pancreas cancer that would be excluded actually from receiving a more aggressive regimen. In this situation, I see a larger applicability and potentially not just for older but younger patients for gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel to be used in the adjuvant setting, of course, in the setting of a randomized clinical trial, that I would imagine that that would be the next step for this regimen.
How have you approached non-protocol adjuvant treatment? There are some people who in some situations actually use adjuvant FOLFIRINOX, although I think most people don't. What about gem nab-paclitaxel outside a trial?
I would continue to be reluctant to use regimens that have been untested in clinical trials. I remain, at this point of time, I do use gemcitabine as a single agent but looking forward to a clinical trial with nab-paclitaxel versus gemcitabine.
Any other research questions you think would be interesting to look at with this combination? And in general, research questions you'd like to see addressed in pancreatic cancer?
Well, I think although this is a great improvement, meaning that it's setting us on the track, there's been so much nihilism in pancreas cancer that we thought we'll never see a day where we're going to be talking about positive studies. This is the second positive study in metastatic setting. So I think the most important question is, one, now we have two regimens that are interesting, gem, nab-paclitaxel, and FOLFIRINOX, two different backbones. And of course, one of the questions will be, which one would be preferentially used in the actual clinical setting? From practical purposes, I think gem, nab-paclitaxel is going to be the most used regimen in actual practice. In reality, we need to address that question in a clinical trial. The second question, I think, is the question that keeps on coming in cancer treatment overall is, how do we select the patients that are more likely to respond? You know, there's a SPARC analysis underway with this regimen that hopefully, based at least on the phase 1-2 study published in JCO, that suggests that we may be able to select those that are more likely to benefit from the treatment. That would be a fantastic question to ask to start with.
Of course, the question always comes up in terms of novel agents, as we're in the era of novel agents in oncology. And you were part of an interesting paper in Annals of Oncology. The title grabbed my attention. VEGF remains an interesting target in advanced pancreatic cancer. And this was a study looking at Bev, Gem, and 5-FU. And curious about that study. But just in general, in terms of anti-angiogenic agents in pancreatic cancer and other novel agents.
So, yes, we chose this title because we thought it was going to be controversial. And actually, the editors kept it because they thought it was actually interesting. So I think one of the biggest interesting pieces with VEGF inhibition in pancreas cancer is one that, at least from a couple of presentations at ESMO and I think ASCO GI previously, it seems that perhaps VEGF A levels may predict who may respond to VEGF inhibitors. But most interestingly, actually, in our study, and based on a number of preclinical studies, we've actually suggested that gemcitabine alone is the wrong backbone to build upon anti-VEGF therapy, and that a fluoropyrimidine, a 5-FU backbone, would probably be more interesting and more likely to induce results. I mean, we reached our primary endpoint with this study, and we've seen actually more than 25% response rate and interesting progression-free survival. And so we made the case that, one, we should select patients better, perhaps by VEGF-A levels. And another point that we presented our findings actually at ASCO last June, that albumin may be a predictor for who may respond to bevacizumab. And patients with normal albumin levels or above have actually been shown to respond better and have a better survival with the application of bevacizumab. And that was actually based on more than 240 patients that we compiled prospectively from multiple studies from multiple institutions.
Has that ever been looked at before?
That has been looked at only in colorectal cancer. And it was interesting because they showed very similar findings in colorectal cancer that was from the original Hurwitz study, AVF-2107, with the IFL plus minus Bev. And so what they've shown is that in a small subgroup, patients who actually had lower albumin levels did less well than patients who had normal or above normal albumin levels.
And I have absolutely no idea why that would happen.
So the assumption is that with low albumin levels, you actually get faster clearance of bevacizumab compared to those patients with normal or high albumin levels. So it has to do with the clearance of bevacizumab.
Wow, interesting. So would that tie into dose?
So that may tie into dose. The problem is it has never been looked at.
Wow.
The assumption is that perhaps, one, you can modify the dose, or two, perhaps exclude patients with a low albumin level from receiving bevacizumab and just focus on those that do have normal or high as a way to select patients who are more likely to respond to VEGF inhibitors, at least the monoclonal antibodies.
So I'm trying to think if I've seen, I think there have been some phase 3 trials with Bev and pancreatic cancer. What do we know about that?
So overwhelmingly negative. So there are two of them, at least, the gemcitabine plus minus bevacizumab, and that's the CLGB 80303 study, which essentially was negative. And this study right now is undergoing actually analysis for looking whether VEGF-A levels may be predictors of response or activity. The other study was the AVITA study with a GEM plus bevacizumab plus erlotinib versus gemcitabine plus erlotinib alone. That study actually showed an improvement in progression-free survival, but the survival was very similar. In this study, what they've done actually, they've looked at stratifying by VEGF-A levels, low and high, and those with VEGF levels that were high were the ones that seemed to benefit significantly in the subgroup analysis from the addition of bevacizumab.
So are either of these phase three studies going to look at albumin?
So unfortunately, the AVITA studies did not collect albumin as we did on our studies. The CLGB study will actually be looking at albumin. Mind you, albumin has been, for the CLGB 80303 study, collected as a research piece based on that Hurwitz finding. And so that data is available, I think, on 200 plus patients. And we're trying to get that data analyzed to confirm our findings.
That's interesting. Of course, finding a predictor for Bev is kind of the holy grail on 5-10 different tumors in oncology. And it seems like things are going back and forth about VEGF-A, how you do the assay. Where are things right now?
So things are actually right now getting refined, if I may simplify it in that term. Old assays that were used have not been as sensitive or predictive. The new assays actually do have much more sensitivity and are more likely to actually capture all the isoforms of VEGF-A and more likely to actually be applicable to the clinical practice. And these are being validated as we speak.
Now, this is a serum test. It's not on the tumor.
No, it's a serum test, not on the tumor. Yes, correct.
Fascinating. So there was a paper at last year's ASCO that I hadn't seen anything like this before, looking at the Oncotype DX colon cancer assay. And this came out of the big C07 NSABP adjuvant Oxali trial. And it looked like using that assay, you could maybe identify people who don't benefit from oxaliplatin. What did you think about that study?
For stage three, actually, I think it's pretty interesting. I think if you can identify patients who will not benefit from oxaliplatin in the adjuvant setting in stage three, that serves two purposes. One, you identify the patients who truly will benefit from oxaliplatin, or you can look at it the other way. You actually identify those patients who do not. The other thing is, of course, you know, neurotoxicity remains one of the biggest limiting factors in a patient who's going to live the rest of his or her life because of the curative resection and the chemotherapy, with a reminder, the neurotoxicity, which in 1.5 to 2% of the patients is a grade 2 or a grade 3, significant neurotoxicity to live with. And if the benefit is 3 to 4%, it's pretty much almost a wash in my viewpoint. So I think that test needs to be further validated, could actually serve a great purpose in the adjuvant setting. The reality of this test is that it is a prognostic test in colon, unlike with breast cancer, where it's actually predictive. And so all what it tells us is that there's a higher chance of recurrence. Now, higher chance of recurrence doesn't necessarily mean that it's a preventable recurrence with chemotherapy. Unless you are able to show that by treating those patients based on the results of this test, you are going to be able to decrease their likelihood of recurrence, then you cannot claim that this test has a predictive role. Right now, it just has a prognostic role and does not help with the choice of chemo.
Certainly, as you mentioned, in breast cancer, you know, that assay, the Oncotype assay, is a part of clinical practice in every oncology practice right now. What do you think about the strategy of just using some type of tissue assay in the adjuvant colorectal setting? Are there any assays in addition to Oncotype that look promising? What do you think about the whole strategy?
So I think a number of them are being developed. There's the Coloprint. There is also a number of other assays that are being looked at. And they're being looked at in a very similar manner that Oncotype has been, although some of them are trying to develop these as predictive assays. Again, if you do not develop your assays in a way that to help to predict, to truly predict who may benefit on chemotherapy versus not, you actually have nothing more than a glorified way to look at the grade of the disease. Meaning, in the past, we used to use moderately differentiated versus poorly differentiated to justify usage of chemotherapy. Today, there's a paper that suggests differentiation doesn't mean anything. It may be prognostic, but it doesn't affect treatment outcome. And I think unless you validate that in a predictive manner, these assays are just going to be an additional piece of the pathology report without much benefit to the patient.
So I want to get your take about a couple of issues coming out at this meeting related to colorectal cancer. First, in terms of EGFR antibodies, can you talk about the PEAK study being reported here?
The PEAK study is actually a first-line FOLFOX plus panitumumab. And these are phase 2 randomized studies. So they have their limitations, of course. They're not phase 3 studies. But they're interesting enough because they address two questions. One, with the first study, PEAK, FOLFOX plus panitumumab versus FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. And the study was powered for progression-free survival, which was not different between the two, which is not surprising. You don't expect one to be superior to the other, frankly. But what caught my eye is actually the response rate, because there's that thought that perhaps with FOLFOX, the addition of an EGFR inhibitor improves the response rate versus bevacizumab. Well, the response rate was very similar between the two, 58 and 54%. The one intriguing piece of the study is the survival, which was perhaps a little bit better with the panitumumab arm, remains to be seen. We don't have the actual report. But on the primary endpoint, this is a wash. Response rate, this is a wash.
That's really interesting. Of course, you know, we're waiting for the big CLGB Alan Vinook study comparing chemo cetuximab to chemo bevacizumab. And particularly where I think there are a lot of people interested when they, I think they're going to try to look at people with liver-only mets. Mm-hmm. How do you approach those kinds of patients in terms of biologics?
So this is, again, a very contentious issue. And you're right, CLGB 80405 will definitely, will hopefully give us a glimpse at that. So let me track back a little bit. The majority of the patients with liver-limited disease will never see surgery. And that's the premise you have to start with. That for those patients, most of them will be treated as every patient with metastatic colorectal cancer. Frankly, if you take away the academic institution reporting of their cases, which is 20 to 40% depending on the size of the institution with liver limited only, that may be borderline resectable or resectable. The majority of the patients that are actually seen in community practices, actually less are seen in academic institutions. If you take all these patients together, we're talking about less than 5% of the patients who will ever have a chance of being borderline resectable or resectable. And out of those, only half are KRAS wild type. So 2 to 3%. And I keep on fractionating, and then another 20, 30% are not. So you end up with about 1.5% of the patients who may be eligible for resection. So we're dealing with a very small percent of patients. Now, the reason why I went through this breakdown is because the strategy, I think, for those patients at this point of time should be very similar to the strategy used overall for metastatic colorectal cancer. So if you use bevacizumab in the first line, which I do with chemotherapy, that would be my standard across the board. And I have not seen today a single study, randomized study, other than hopefully the results of CLGB 80405, which will be presented later at ASCO, that actually compared the VEGF inhibitor to the EGFR inhibitor. And to actually today to make the claim that a response rate is better in one versus the other is not substantiated by randomized data. The outcomes are very similar. I think the PEAK study tells us that perhaps with FOLFOX there's not much of a difference in the response rate, because response rate is what actually enhances the likelihood of resectability. And at this point of time, there is no convincing data that an EGFR inhibitor indeed does improve the outcome. So I remain at this point of time, I remain bullish on using a VEGF inhibitor in the first line with chemotherapy, so bevacizumab specifically, with chemotherapy for all these patients, including the patients who have borderline resectable disease. And that's in accordance with the NCCN guidelines as well.
So let's finish up with gastric cancer, and maybe we can start out with your 48-year-old lady.
So this was an interesting case. Again, an unfortunate younger female, 48-year-old white female, who actually, again, presented to her primary care physician with the typical symptoms you see with gastric cancer, early satiety and weight loss. and some difficulty in swallowing. The EGD and upper endoscopy was performed on June 2012, and that showed a fungating mass actually close to the pylorus, more distal. And a biopsy showed a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma. And this patient was considered resectable. We presented her at the tumor board, and the discussions went back and forth. As you know, there is data suggesting that perioperative chemotherapy with ECF before and after surgery would benefit patients. And we have our own data from the INT study by McDonald with 5-FU followed by 5-FU radiation in the adjuvant setting following resection. And the main discussion was, you know, should we proceed with chemo perioperatively versus the adjuvant chemotherapy and radiation? The decision was made to actually proceed with gastrectomy and then followed by chemotherapy and radiation. And the main reason for that is actually fairly documented actually in the literature. In the United States, we perform suboptimal resections, suboptimal D1s, with just minimal lymph nodectomy, sometimes even just a gastrectomy with few lymph nodes, which is a suboptimal resection compared to the majority in Europe and then to the overwhelming majority in Asia that go for D2 or D2 plus, which is a more aggressive resection, more extensive lymphadenectomy, and then removal of spleen, etc. And so one of the main differences between the resections we perform in the United States and the resections that are performed outside the United States is the fact that we have a higher likelihood of local recurrences. And therefore, although a lot of the studies outside the United States suggest that radiation may not have a role, I think in the U.S., because of the way we perform the surgeries, radiation remains essential for our patients with gastric resection because of the patterns of recurrence. And this was the main decision why we proceeded with this resection and followed by chemotherapy and radiation.
So could I just interject a sort of related question, which is, in what situations do you use neoadjuvant systemic therapy? And in those situations, if the patient has a HER2-positive tumor, will you add trastuzumab?
That's a very interesting question. So we have been thinking about for patients who are less performant, who are more symptomatic, to actually proceed with chemotherapy prior to surgery and keep radiation after the surgery. So it's, if I may call this a modified magic, where you give chemotherapy up front and you give the radiation, chemotherapy and radiation after surgery. So although there is no indication for trastuzumab in the neoadjuvant setting, for a HER2-positive patient, I actually feel compelled to use trastuzumab added to chemotherapy neoadjuvantly. And the main reason for that is, again, the intent of giving preoperative chemotherapy, one of the main intents is to actually have a response. And we know that, at least from the TOGA trial, that adding trastuzumab to a HER2-positive tumor in addition to chemotherapy increases the response rate by about 10%. And so for patients with HER2-positive tumors, where we decide we want to proceed with neoadjuvant chemotherapy or perioperative or preoperative chemotherapy, we actually do add trastuzumab to chemotherapy.
So I'm going to guess if you flip it onto the other side of surgery, you don't add trastuzumab?
I do not, because, again, the goals become different.
I got to say, when I saw that TOGA data came out, I mean, when we do breast cancer programs nowadays, we spend half our time talking about anti-HER therapy. I've been kind of disappointed that we haven't seen more. I realize it's not as common a tumor and the, you know, low fraction overall number of patients, but is there anything going on from a research perspective in terms of HER2-positive gastric cancer?
So right now there are actually, there's the RTOG study that's looking at the role of trastuzumab added to chemotherapy and radiation in patients with HER2-positive tumors, and this is for gastroesophageal and esophageal cancer. So in our institution, we actually have two studies ongoing, CLGB80803, which essentially is a neoadjuvant study, and then the RTOG study. And so both are going at the same time, and we stratify patients by HER2 in our own clinics by HER2 positivity. Those that are HER2 positive will go to the RTOG study, and those that are not will go to the CLGB study. Between the two studies, we have identified, and this has been ongoing for about a year, about 10 or 11 patients, two of them ended up going on the RTOG study, just to give you an idea about the ratio, and nine actually on the CLGB study.
So getting back to this lady, can you bring us up to date?
Yeah, so essentially she underwent gastrectomy on July 2012, and the surgical pathology showed a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, so confirming the biopsy, with 7 out of 13 lymph nodes were positive. Unfortunately, she ended up with a margin that was positive, so she was an R1 resectional status. She did recover well from her surgery, and then on August 2012, we started her on the adjuvant treatment, and in a way, this is a modified version of the McDonald regimen. We have stopped using bolus 5-FU altogether in our practices. And so we use the infusional 5-FU Degremont. She got 2 doses of those, so for 4 weeks. And then continuous infusion 5-FU with radiation followed. The plan is to follow by more infusional 5-FU with the Degremont again for 8 weeks. So a total of about 6 months of adjuvant therapy starting August. So far, she's tolerating the treatment fairly well.
As you look into her future, what do you think the likelihood is that she's going to have a local recurrence?
So I think the local recurrence rate will hopefully be diminished by the application of the radiation. I think her local recurrence rate remains high, closer to 50%+. I think her rate of overall recurrence is probably close to 90 to 100%, unfortunately, because of her R1 resectional status. So I think in this situation, I think 2 things, and I have to think retrospectively about every time we treat a patient and think what should we have done a little bit differently. I think in this situation, this case emphasizes to me perhaps to consider, especially for, and this patient was still fairly tolerable, to consider chemotherapy with the stratification for her too, with chemotherapy preoperatively, prior to surgical resection, to test, one, the biology of the disease. I think the chemotherapy will allow us to have enough time to understand whether this is an aggressive tumor that's not going to benefit much from surgery. Secondly, if the biology is favorable, in a situation like this, we could actually improve the R0 resection rate, and therefore we could actually end up with less a likelihood of ending up with an R1 resection. So for these 2 reasons, when looking back, I think that perhaps what I call a modified magic, meaning a preoperative chemotherapy, and depending on HER2 status, consider adding trastuzumab, followed by resection, followed by chemotherapy and radiation in the adjuvant setting, would probably be an optimal approach. Granted that there is no data for this except infer from multiple studies.